Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. No guest today, because the second part of our program, I'm going to play part one of a three-part series from Bill Moyers, The Secret Government. This was actually produced back in 1987. I find it as relevant as today. It also will give those in this audience who may not be very clear upon the malignancies within the Reagan administration. All we hear today, mainly from Republicans and some corporate Democrats, is the Reagan legacy. This is a part of the legacy that actually happened, is fully documented, that has been scrubbed from history. But it's there. We'll share it with you. Also this week, we'll be doing several different exposés, an original investigative reporting piece on something that we all are impacted by, the quality of the food that we eat. And this is an original white paper. We have published it already online, and it deals with genetic modification of food, but in a way of letting you know the politics of the industry, the people involved, their history, what they have done, and why you should be very concerned about anyone coming forward to claim that GMOs are safe and effective in helping eliminate starvation, feeding people. None of that is true. This expose goes into it in great depth. Today, we're going to begin our program, as always, looking at the latest in health and nutrition, and we're going to look at the popular Southern fare. It's specialized. There are even television shows on it. But what is it? Well, coming from the South, I found this extremely interesting, but this doesn't come from me. This comes from the University of Alabama School of Medicine, and it's really an indictment. Also, I've said many times, for those of you that take antacids, you're actually blocking nutrients from being absorbed. Well, now there's a new study on this that says the same thing. I'll share that with you. Leading physicians, I mean a large group of orthodox physicians, have finally come forward and in a major article in the American Journal of Medicine talked about how they're ignorant about health and therefore they need a lot more training. They have no knowledge of nutrition. Well, at least they've been honest about it. So I'll share that with you. That's a good step. Nearly one in five Americans drinks at least one can of soda a day. That's according to the CDC. Now, that's based upon all. If you take into account teenagers, then you're looking at a whole lot more than one in five teenagers. I'll deal with that as well. I don't think I'll have time for many other things today because I want to make sure that we get the full 27 minutes in of part one of The Secret War. But I will be dealing with the militarization of the police this week. Keep in mind, I wrote an article about the silent hand. I did a five-part series on the silent hand. I did a 10-part series on fascism, how we're becoming a police state. Isn't it interesting that now those are all happening? So we'll revisit what it is to be a police state. Who's not affected? Who is? All this week. Let's begin. This is from the University of Alabama School of Medicine. Here's what they say. Quote, the types of food that many Southerners seem to prefer, fried foods, sweet drinks, and processed meals, may be deadly for people with kidney disease. The Southern-style diet is associated with a 50% greater risk of death over a six-year period for people with kidney disease. The researchers believe the death risk increases because kidney patients have an impaired ability to filter out harmful fats, sugars, and minerals contained in a typical Southern diet. Quote, people who have kidney disease have a harder time getting rid of a lot of the substances in these types of foods that are bad for you. That's according to a kidney expert at the University of Alabama School of Medicine, Dr. Gutritz. By the same token, A diet high in fruits and vegetables appeared to reduce the risk of death by nearly a quarter in kidney patients. And this is published in the peer-reviewed American Journal of Kidney Disease. I watched the transformation of the Southern diet from when I was a kid. In fact, one of my earliest memories was when on a Saturday morning in the summertime, bringing in the truck, containers of milk. And we'd take them to a general store in the lower part of Parkersburg. Now, the very low part of Parkersburg was at the Point, and that's where the Kanawha River and the Ohio River merge. And right down there, just a short distance, is Blennerhassett Island, and which is a famous place. And a lot of the activity taking place was commerce on the river. Hence, a lot of communities, most communities, built their commerce centers where trading was done on the banks of those rivers. Parkersburg was no different. Here I'm in an old general store. Now, when I say old general store, it was really old. It was pre-Civil War built. And it had that smell, that old wood smell. And I remember going in as a kid, probably 5, 6 years old, and there'd always be a group of really older men sitting around this pot-bellied stove and whittling wood. I wouldn't hear them say a word. But one of them, my father told me, was about 100 years of age. Now, that's a long time. And back then, the diet was not a high-processed diet. It wasn't even a bad diet. Root vegetables were very common. Collard greens and Swiss chard and kale, very common. Beans were a ubiquitous part of the diet. Fresh fruit in season, but then preserved fruit or dried fruit out of season. A lot of sugar in that, of course, not good for you. And a lot of the beans and other things that were preserved in jars, more often than in cans, because people didn't can anything, they jarred it. And everyone that I knew, every home I went in, always had preserves, meaning they had food that had been preserved. It might be beets or string beans, but they would always have it on a shelf. And that's what they ate generally during the winter, where their locally grown food was simply non-existent. Nobody had greenhouses. So the first, when pumpkins and squash, which were, and root vegetables like sweet potatoes and yams, which were ubiquitous in the Southern diet, you didn't see that up north, and certainly didn't see it in the West, but sure did have sweet potato everything in the South, and yam everything. They'd find 1,000 ways to make yam. And so that would be the end of it. So about mid-October, you'd pretty much be out of your anything you were going to harvest. And most people would exchange and share items with each other. And I remember so many times my mother and my aunt would do all of the pickling and canning, and I would watch them. They would do hundreds and hundreds of jars. And I once asked, "Who's all this for?" And my mom would just smile and say, "Whoever's hungry." And so at church, they would always take, every Sunday, they would always take a bag of food, knowing that someone was having a hard time. And it was all done very discreetly. It was all left with the pastor, and then the pastor would call in the person after everything was done and just give it to them, you know. And it's the way that we grew up. If someone was in need, you helped them. It was just that simple. And I had a chance to go down to Clay Street. And Clay Street is where the blacks lived. Now, there were only a couple of exceptions. When I say a couple, I mean like two. And one of them was my best friend, Tony Bartlett. And we grew up since we were born, just one block away. And since my mother and father were the ones who were responsible in our neighborhood for making sure that there was no violence against blacks, and my father was intolerant against that. But the Bartletts were canning all the time, always had the most interesting garden, would be growing everything, and the oldest person in that Bartlett family was very old. And it was through her that one day, as a teenager, I met a woman who was, again, about 100 years of age and talked about what it was like growing up in the Deep South in Georgia as a small kid during the Civil War, what they ate, how they lived, how they were treated. And that was my first exposure to this firsthand from a person who actually had lived then. And there was always a stock room, and a stock room was a room not very large, depending upon the size of the home, and from ceiling to floor, wall to wall, it was all jars of every kind of preserve imaginable. And there was also a way that you could take beeswax or honey, I've seen it both ways, and you massage the apples in them, and it allowed the apple to last all year. So you got your apples in the fall, you wax them or put bee honey on them, and then you put them in a cool cellar. And I remember the storage cellars. A lot of Americans today have no idea what a storage cellar is. They've never seen it. If you go about 8 foot underground, it stays about 55 degrees 12 months a year. Unless something extreme happens, it's never into the freezing and it's never into the high heat, and that's where you put your baskets of root vegetables. Of course, I also learned that you could go out in the middle of the snow, in the middle of February, and brush off the snow, and if you got down to the vegetable, like a carrot or something that was in the ground, you could harvest it. Today, we think that everything has to be harvested all at once and then used. Not true. And I saw how they made dried fruit because I used to make it, where you would cut, you would wash. First, you washed, and you use downers. Downers are the fruit that actually fall on the ground first because of the most ripe. You wash it, you cut it, you take out the rock stone, which is the pit, and then you put it on a screen. And then a muslin cloth goes over the screen, and 4 days later, you flip it over, you do the other side. Now, providing you haven't had rain, you've got a nice dried fruit, and it will last years. And so I saw these giant barrels, 55-gallon keg, wooden barrels, and they'd be labeled apricots or peaches or nectarines or plums, pears. There'd be a whole bunch of these. And so when people think that somehow there was no food in the wintertime, they just didn't understand there was a lot of food in the wintertime. It looked like a veritable health food store, including herbs. And I share all this with you because I saw how different cultures and different ages and people, what their diet was like, how they lived, what they talked about, the significance of family, being able to eat a meal together, manners, grooming yourself when you went out in public, and certainly when you went to church, everybody. And I had the advantage of actually going to one church, but then I found that the singing was much better at the Baptist church, which is down at the base of Clay Street, and that was a Black Baptist church. But because I was friends and my family were friends, they didn't have any problem with me coming in, and I just loved the energy. And besides, these were my friends, and I grew up in that environment. So I had a very deep connection, a very soulful connection with people, and saw how they were segregated against. There was still a segregated school in my town, Sumner School. And I also saw the prejudice and the bias against them. I even remember once there was a football game that we won, but the person who won the game for us was not invited to the party to celebrate the game afterwards. And I challenged the person whose home it was in, who I won't mention because she's still alive, and her father, and why they wouldn't invite the person who won the game. And that was the last time I ever went to any of their parties. I wasn't going to. I was going to stand in solidarity with my friend. So when you come from a background where you've had firsthand experience with diet, with lifestyle, with behavior, and you learn some lessons, then you look today and you see how some things have changed tremendously, but other things have remained the same. So when we look at today's popular Southern diet, you also have to look at today's popular Southern lifestyle. And there's extremes. Those who go out of their way to be healthy, and those who go out of their way just to eat as much as they can, of salt and crunchy, sweet and soft. Go to the restaurants that give you the biggest portions of food. And these are not stupid people. These are people who are fully aware, just like those who smoke or drink, that there'll be an outcome. They just hope that it's not today. And I've seen people, and I've spoken with people, who go to a restaurant that serves them a 2-pound steak. That's a week and a half's worth of protein in one meal. And they'll do this as frequently as they can. And you look at them, they're morbidly obese. And they have diabetes and high blood pressure and migraine headaches and urinary incontinence and prematurely aged. And the women go through menopause much quicker with more extreme symptoms. And no one seems to see that what they do is directly contributing to this. But it is. And those who advocate health, they're appreciated. Hey, one of my most popular cities, when I go to lecture, packed. And no advertising at all. Just thousands of people show up. Is Atlanta. Lots of health-minded people in Atlanta. But it's also one of the cities that has one of the highest rates of obesity and heart disease in America. And the further south you go from Atlanta, you go down, go up to South Carolina, you get it there. You go to Alabama, Arkansas, Mississippi, Louisiana. You're right in the vortex of the worst health habits in America, the worst health in America, the fattest kids, the fattest adults, the most heart disease, the most cancers, the most obesity, the most diabetes in America. And yet there is absolutely no program that is there to help educate the public about what the choices are likely to be negatively and how to turn them around. But those who want to be helped, they'll find the information. So I'm happy to see that the University of Alabama School of Medicine is finally saying it, and it's all in their headlines, quote, popular southern fare may harm your kidneys. Oh, it harms more than the kidneys. It harms the whole, look in their mouth, look at the amount of dental caries, look at the amount of teeth that have cavities by the age of 5. I've also been very concerned about the fact that we will show a commercial, and you've all seen the commercial, I'm sure, where someone goes to eat something and the food smacks them in the face, but not to worry. Antacid is here, and now they can eat any of that bad food. What is the message that gives us? Well, what they're not saying is, eat the bad food and stop its digestion. Well, what exactly is supposed to happen to it? I mean, what if you turn on a washing machine where all of the laundry had fallen into a septic tank and was filled to the stained completely and soiled with human excrement, and you started to wash it, and 1 minute into the cycle, you turn off the machine because it's making too much noise. Is it going to be clean? Are you going to take the clothes out and wear them? Now imagine that you've just eaten pizzas, barbecued ribs, washed it down with a soda. You have massive indigestion, so you take an antacid. It will work by turning off hydrochloric acid in the stomach. What exactly is supposed to happen with all that undigested food? Because it's not in the form of a soup like chyme. It's still like bolus, which is large particle matter. It dumps it into the intestine. And then this dumping sensation means that non-digested, bioavailable foods, the way they should be, get into your intestine. A, vitamins are not going to be absorbed. Enzymes are not absorbed. Minerals are not absorbed. So now you run the risk of being overfed and undernourished. Malabsorption syndrome. But then, because you're putting so much bad food into your body and it's highly acidic, you have leaky gut. And with a leaky gut, particulate matter from that undigested food goes into your bloodstream. And then the body attacks it because it doesn't recognize it. So if it was an amino acid from the hamburger, it would recognize it. But if it's a bunch of meat, It won't recognize it. It attacks as a foreign agent. Now you end up creating autoimmune disease. And gee whiz, just guess which disease is epidemic in America? Autoimmune. Inflammatory joint disorders manifesting in other parts of our body, fibromyalgia. Because we are blocking hydrochloric acid, we're not getting proper digestion, and we're getting nutrient deficiency. This is the latest study to confirm this. And I don't believe people should be using the antacid blockers like Zantac and Tagamet, and because they're really serious. Instead, just eat properly. Eat living foods. Eat healthy foods. And there was a study on this talking exactly about what I just shared, showing that you end up with malabsorption and your stomach is not allowing the body to absorb the vitamin B12 that you need. And this was done by Swedish researchers. Next up, Americans, well, 1 in 5 drinks at least one soda a day. I wish 1 in 5 Americans drank a fresh juice each day. That would be terrific, but they're not. So what we have is, instead of enzyme, phytonutrient, antioxidant, healing juices like watermelon with lemon, apple, cucumber, celery, cabbage for upset stomachs or ulcers is terrific. Putting in fresh fennel, making a fennel juice as a topping, but adding in bok choy and kale and cucumber and celery. Great for problems with the kidneys and liver. We're not doing that. We're taking a carbonated, artificially sweetened or sugar sweetened soft drink. This is the latest in the CDC. Quote, a new survey of American adults across 18 states finds 17% drinking at least one sugary soda per day. For example, while about 12% of people in New York State or Hawaii down one or more non-diet sodas each day, that number jumped to 32% in Tennessee and Mississippi. There you are in the South again. The report from researchers at US CDC also found high levels of sweetened fruit drink consumption, up 12% of the adult population. Quote, I think most people still don't realize just how much sugar is found in these sugar-sweetened beverages. Well, you get a lot of them. And that's why we have diabetes, metabolic syndrome. Quote, regular soda and fruit drink contain added sugars and are sources of calories, but have few, if any, essential nutrients. And that was in the journal Morbidity and Mortality Weekly from the CDC. Finally, for those of you who are in the healthcare profession and you've taken the time to take your courses, pass your exams, did your internships, you know how difficult it is to help someone if you have no knowledge in the field where they need help. And yet, for the last 40 or 50 years, the majority of physicians in the United States have had no problem telling people, eat everything in moderation, drink everything in moderation, as if a moderate amount of a toxin would not have an impact upon the body. They know nothing about real healing and health. After all, their mastery is in pathology. This is from the Gables Institute of Integrative Cardiology. Quote, doctors often lack adequate training in nutrition to give patients the care they need. That is the conclusion of the nation's leading physicians in the upcoming issue next week of the American Journal of Medicine. Diet is the top risk factor for disability and premature death in America. Yet physician accreditation standards don't even mention the word nutrition despite very specific requirements in other areas. Quote, nutrition is the low-hanging fruit in medicine, a low-cost intervention with untapped potential for optimizing health. That's the lead author of the report, A Deficiency of Nutritional Education and Medical Training, by Dr. Stephen DeVries, cardiologist and the executive director of the Gables Institute for Integrative Cardiology. So what we're looking at is the fact that it is estimated at least $315 billion is spent annually in the United States on cardiovascular disease. And they're saying it could be cut substantially if Americans embrace modest dietary changes. I would agree with that. But I also know that if we got a national program going showing people how to make healthier selections, we could cut our $3.3 trillion medical bill by $1 trillion and save a lot of suffering and lives. I am happy that they finally recognize that they don't have the education, because you have no idea how many times people have sat across me saying, my doctor said that, you know, it doesn't matter. I can eat corn and wheat and dairy and all this stuff and sugar as long as I eat it in moderation. I said, okay, how much is moderation? You have congestive heart failure. You have edema. You have high blood pressure. You have elevated LDL cholesterol. You have fibrinogen, C-reactive protein, and homocysteine all elevated. Exactly what now is a moderate amount of a pro-inflammatory cytokine? I don't know. The gross arrogance, ignorance, and narcissism within the medical community has caused millions upon millions of unnecessary deaths and hundreds of millions of suffering, because they weren't willing to turn their attention to people who knew the field of prevention and nutrition and exercise and stress management. It wasn't on the curriculum because it doesn't make money. It's that simple. Just look to see who creates the curriculum in medical schools. It's the pharmaceutical industry. Who owns the accreditation capacity of all state medical boards and medical schools? It's done through the AMA, which is a union for doctors with an extremely sordid and criminal behavior background. It had one of the most nefarious idiots in the history of American medicine, a Dr. Fishbein, who ran it for decades. And that's when the ads for smoking's good for you came into their journals. So the pharmaceutical industry is behind it all. We got to break that bond. I'm Gary Noll. That's the latest in health nutrition. Back in a moment with Bill Moyers, part one of a three-part series, a very enlightening piece on the secret government.
I started thinking was, this must happen all the time. This time they just got caught.
People lined up early every day, waiting to listen in person to the Iran-Contra hearings, while millions watched from home on television. Members of the secret government had been forced from the shadows into the spotlight.
I will tell you right now, Council, and all the members here gathered, that I misled the Congress.
At that meeting.
Face to face.
You made false statements to them about your activities in support of the Contras.
I did.
Oliver North had been the secret government's chronic liar, long on zeal for his president and the cause. But he was not the only zealot, not the only one to deceive. The hearings revealed a wholesale policy of secrecy shrouded in lies, of passion cloaked in fiction and deception. But the hearings told only part of the story, so let's begin on day one.
I, Ronald Reagan, do solemnly swear that I
will... President Reagan came to office promising to restore America's military and moral prestige in the world. Voters had responded when he pledged to be tough on terrorists, a vow he repeated time and again.
Let me further make it plain to the assassins in Beirut and their accomplices, wherever they may be, that America will never make concessions to terrorists.
That's what the president kept saying, but it's not what he was doing. The story broke 1 year ago, on November 3, 1986, in a magazine in Lebanon. The United States had defied its own embargo on arms to Iran. Ronald Reagan was offering weapons to the Ayatollah Khomeini in return for the release of American hostages. The president went on television to deny it.
The charge has been made that the United States has shipped weapons to Iran as ransom payment for the release of American hostages in Lebanon. That the United States undercut its allies and secretly violated American policy against trafficking with terrorists. Those charges are utterly false.
The president was not telling the truth. And when he held a news conference the next week, the pattern of deception continued.
President, I don't think it's still clear just what Israel's role was in this. Could you explain what the Israeli role was here?
No, because we, as I say, have had nothing to do with other countries or their shipment of arms or doing what they're doing.
That wasn't the truth either. Half an hour later, the White House press office corrected the president. Israel had been a key player in the sale of arms to Iran. Rapidly now, the web of secrets was unraveling. On November 25th, the president's old friend and ally, Attorney General Edwin Meese, revealed the deepest secret of all.
Certain monies which were received in the transaction between representatives of Israel and representatives of Iran were taken and made available to the forces in Central America which are opposing the Sandinista government there.
The Constitution is ambiguous on many things, but not on this. The president, quote, shall take care that the laws be faithfully executed. Yet President Reagan himself approved selling arms to Iran. And as for the illegal diversion of funds to the Contras, well, the president's national security advisor said the decision had been his.
I made a very deliberate decision not to ask the president so that I could insulate him from the decision and provide some future deniability for the president if it ever leaked out.
But there was no denying that the president's men knew what was in the president's mind.
And he had been very adamant at the time that he says, look, I don't want to pull out our support for the Contras for any reason. This would be an unacceptable option. Isn't there something that I could do unilaterally?
Unilaterally. In other words, without congressional approval. Ronald Reagan's message was clear. Find some way, anyway, to help the Contras.
So I guess in a way they are counter-revolutionary, and God bless them for being that way. And I guess that makes them Contras, and so it makes me a Contra, too.
The Contras. Ronald Reagan compared them to our founding fathers. In reality, Ronald Reagan and CIA Director William Casey were their founding fathers. 2 months after his inauguration, the president approved the funds which Casey used to create the Contras. Their ultimate goal was the violent overthrow of the Nicaraguan government, a government the United States legally recognizes. So the war had to be carried out covertly as a campaign of terror. But Americans were outraged when CIA agents mined the Nicaraguan harbors and blew up fuel tanks, causing thousands of Nicaraguan citizens to flee their homes. Congress, in protest, cut off the Contra funds. When the president refused to give up on his creation, the Contras cheered.
Viva Reagan! Viva Reagan!
But how to keep the Contra war going despite Congress, the law, and public opinion? First, a small cabal in the White House took charge of policy. The president, CIA Director Casey, National Security Advisors McFarlane and Poindexter, and their aide, Colonel North, who did not wear his Marine uniform when he worked for the secret government. To raise money for the Contras, the secret team turned to right-wing governments that could do favors for the United States and receive favors in return. The king of Saudi Arabia doled out $1 million a month. The Sultan of Brunei coughed up $10 million that was misplaced through a White House error. The secret government also encouraged the fundraising efforts of General John Singlaib. Relieved of his command for insubordination in 1977, he now runs the World Anti-Communist League.
I represent hundreds of thousands of Americans who are sympathetic to your cause and want to help.
Here at home, wealthy right-wingers were solicited directly by Oliver North. Some of them were told their contributions would get them invited to the Oval Office. Conservative activist Carl Channel, who later pleaded guilty to conspiracy to defraud the government, worked directly with Colonel North, pumping donors like investor Joseph Aboyle.
I take it your encounters invariably involved both Mr. Channel and Colonel North, and maybe Channel took you to North, and then you met with North, and then subsequently you would meet with Channel, but in a sense they worked as a team.
In a sense, yes.
Mrs. Garwood, is that true in your instance as well?
I would say that's a fairly accurate description.
All this was being done to advance the president's policies, but it wasn't enough. To get around the law, the White House then enlisted the services of something called the Enterprise.
The Enterprise is the group of companies that Mr. Hakim formed to manage the Contra and the Iranian project.
Who controls the Enterprise?
I exercised overall control.
General Richard Secord has been in and out of covert operations for a quarter century. One of the first Americans to fly secret missions in Vietnam, he also helped run the CIA's secret war in Laos. Secord became a major Pentagon figure in foreign military sales, especially to the Shah of Iran. That's where he met this man, Albert Hakim.
Not only was I presented with an opportunity to help my country, the United States, and my native land, Iran, but at the same time, I had the opportunity to profit financially.
Albert Hakim was Secord's partner in the Enterprise. Born in Iran, he made millions selling American-made arms to the Shah, often relying on bribes and illegal payoffs to ease the way. Now he handled financial matters for the Enterprise. Like any good business, the Enterprise was designed to make money.
Am I correct, Mr. Secord, that from December 1984 until July 1985, you were engaged in selling arms to the Contras for profit?
That's correct.
Then, at the direct request of the secret White House team, the Enterprise brokered American arms to the Ayatollah Khomeini. Beyond Secord and Hakim, it grew to include a shadowy network of arms dealers, fraudulent companies, and secret bank accounts. The Enterprise was, as Senator Daniel Inouye put it,
a shadowy government with its own Air Force, its own Navy, its own fundraising mechanism, and the ability to pursue its own ideas of the national interest, free from all checks and balances, and free from the law itself.
Here's just one example of how the Enterprise worked. With the full knowledge of William Casey and Oliver North, Secord and Hakim controlled secret bank accounts in Switzerland that received those contributions from private citizens. The money was then funneled to the Contras. One donor was Joseph Coors, the millionaire beer tycoon. Coors met directly with Casey, who referred him to North.
I told him that I was interested in seeing what I could do, and I asked him for his recommendation.
And did North, subsequent to the meeting, provide you the Swiss bank account name and number to which your payment should be made?
Yes, he did. And
what was Joseph Coors deposited $65,000 into the secret account, but that was peanuts compared to the arms deals. Secord purchased 1,000 missiles from the CIA for $3.7 million and sold them to an Iranian middleman for $10 million. On that one transaction alone, after expenses, the Enterprise made a profit of $5.5 million, almost 200%. Its overall profits on the sales to Iran may have been as much as $15 million.
You did, in fact, use some of those proceeds, approximately, and correct me if my recollection is wrong, about $3.5 million, for the Contra effort in Central America.
Yes, sir.
But most of the money never reached the Contras, including $8 million remaining today in a private Swiss account. Operating in secret, the enterprise was free to put profits above patriotism. They even sold arms directly to the Contras at a huge markup.
If the purpose of the enterprise was to help the Contras, why did you charge Calero a markup that included a profit?
We were in business to make a living, Senator. We had to make a living. I didn't see anything wrong with it at the time. It was a commercial enterprise.
Oh, I thought the purpose of the enterprise was to aid Calero's cause.
Can't I have two purposes?
Right.
I did.
While profits were being made, lives were being lost. Iran has used missiles supplied by the enterprise to fight its war against Iraq. That war has already lasted more than 7 years, as many as 1 million people killed or wounded. And in Nicaragua, the Contras use weapons from the enterprise against civilians. It's a terrorist war they're fighting. Old men, women, children are caught in the middle or killed deliberately as the Contras use violence against peasants to pressure their government. Thousands have died. Even as the hearings were taking place in Washington this summer, a Contra raid in Nicaragua killed 3 children and a pregnant woman. As the casualties mounted, the secret government in Washington knew that the Contra leaders were not such noble freedom fighters after all. Colonel North learned that from his own liaison with the Contras, Robert Owen.
I was but a private foot soldier who believed in the cause of the Nicaraguan democratic resistance.
Owen sent a secret memo to his boss. He reminded North that the chief Contra leader, Adolfo Calero, is a creation of the United States government. And he warned North that those around Calero, quote, are not first-rate people. They're liars, greed and power motivated. This war, he said, has become a business to many of them. Owen's judgment has been supported by disillusioned rebels who quit the struggle in disgust with Contra leaders.
People who had never dirtied their boots, people who never went to the field, people who didn't even know how to pick up a rifle, pretending being a facade for the CIA, and whose only concern was making money.
Alberto Sur is a former Contra officer who once won the personal congratulations of Ronald Reagan, but then he discovered corruption among the Contras.
They bought shoddy goods and put them at hiked up prices. They bought low-grade grains like rice and beans and corn and sugar and salt and put them up for sale or build them for themselves at the highest prices. They did the same with ammunitions. They did the same with rifles.
All this, the contempt for Congress, the defiance of law, the huge markups and profits, the secret bank accounts, the shady characters, the shakedown of foreign governments, the complicity in death and destruction, they did all this in the dark because it would never stand the light of day. Secrecy is the freedom zealots dream of. No watchman to check the door, no accountant to check the books, no judge to check the law. The secret government has no constitution. The rules it follows are the rules it makes up. So William Casey could dream that the enterprise might take on a life of its own, permanent and wholly unaccountable.
The director was interested in the ability to go to an existing, as he put it, off-the-shelf, self-sustaining, standalone entity that could perform certain activities on behalf of the United States.
Are you not shocked that the director of Central Intelligence is proposing to you the creation of an organization to do these kinds of things outside of his own organization?
Counsel, I can tell you I'm not shocked.
They were willing to literally put the Constitution at risk because they believed somehow there was a higher order of things, that the ends do in fact are justified by the means. That's the most Marxist totalitarian doctrine I've ever heard of in my life.
Senator John Kerry of Massachusetts, a veteran of the Vietnam War, is a member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee.
If you can have a retired general and a colonel, you know, in mufti running around, making deals in other countries on their own, soliciting funds to wage wars to overthrow governments, and hide it from the American people so you have no accountability, you've done the very thing that James Madison and others feared most when they were struggling to put the Constitution together, which was to create an accountable system which didn't have runaway power, which didn't concentrate power in one hand so that you could have one person making a decision and running off against the will of the American people.
Ultimately, what could possibly justify it? The fight against communism, of course.
This nation cannot abide the communization of Central America. We cannot have Soviet bases on the mainland of this hemisphere.
It means dirty wars and dirty tricks, lying and deceit.
These operations were designed to be secrets from the American people.
Mr. Niels, I'm at a loss as to how we could announce it to the American people and not have the Soviets know about it.
Well, in fact, Colonel North, you believed that the Soviets were aware of our sale of arms to Iran, weren't you?
We came to a point in time when we were concerned about that.
Since our adversaries know about covert operations, the only people fooled are the American people. But consent is the very heart of our constitutional system. How can people judge what they do not know, or what they are told falsely? It's something troubling Americans these days.
All the neighborhoods around here who get to talking about politics, they used to talk about the bureaucrats. You know, used to talk just about politicians, the kind of slick people, just like used car salesmen or what else have you. Lawyers get thrown into that whole pack, too. Now they're talking about the liars. That's what I hear all the time. Well, the liars are at it again, you know.
We do live in a democracy, don't we?
We do, sir. Thank God.
In which it is the people, not one Marine Lieutenant Colonel, that get to decide the important policy decisions for the nation.
Yes.
It isn't the first time that men who express reverence for democracy in public have violated the values of democracy in practice. The secret government is an interlocking network of official functionaries, spies, mercenaries, ex-generals, profiteers, and super-patriots who, for a variety of motives, operate outside the legitimate institutions of government. Presidents have turned to them when they can't win the support of the Congress or the people, creating that unsupervised power so feared by the framers of our Constitution. Just imagine that William Casey's dream came true. Suppose the enterprise grew into a super-secret, self-financing, self-perpetuating organization. Suppose they decided on their own to assassinate Gorbachev or the leader of white South Africa. Could a president control them? And what if he became the enterprise's public enemy number one? Who would know? Who would say no? During the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia, Lenin created something called the Cheka, a secret organization run by 8 lieutenants reporting directly to him and filled with zealots who sabotaged and terrorized opponents. They made up their own rules, they chose their own missions, and they judged their own operations. You say it can't happen here. Well, before deciding for sure, let's look at the history of our secret government. World War II was over. Europe lay devastated. The United States emerged as the most powerful nation on Earth. But from the rubble rose a strange new world, a peace that was not peace, and a war that was not war. We saw it emerging when the Soviets occupied Eastern Europe. The Cold War had begun.
An iron curtain has descended across the continent. Behind that line lie all the capitals of the ancient states of Central and Eastern Europe.
The Russians had been our ally against the Nazis, an expedient alliance for the sake of war. Now they were our enemy. To fight them, we turned to some of the very men who had inflicted on humanity the horrors of Hitler's madness. We hired Nazis as American spies. We struck a secret bargain with the devil.
One that I know real well is Klaus Barbie. He was wanted by the French as their number one war criminal. And somehow we employed a man like that as a very secretive informant.
Erhard Dabringhaus was employed in the U.S. Army Counterintelligence Corps and assigned to work with Nazi informants spying on the Russians. One of them was Klaus Barbie, the Butcher of Lyon, who had tortured and murdered thousands of Jews and resistance fighters.
During the time I learned that Barbie was really such a brutal murderer, I reported this to my headquarters and I thought I was going to get a promotion. I thought there was a big picture of a deal I had here, you know. And the answer was, Dabringhouse, keep quiet until he's no longer useful, then we'll turn him over to the French. Under those conditions, I thought, well, okay, let's work with him. You know, if you're an intelligence officer, you work with the devil.
The Americans did not turn Barbie over to the French when they finished with him. They helped him escape to Bolivia. Other top Nazis were smuggled into the United States to cooperate in the war against the new enemy. Dabringhouse still remembers the attitude of his superiors. The new enemy was the only enemy.
They seem to have had a preconceived program of what the communists are up to. And if I send in a report that there was a Nazi war criminal running around over there, forget it, we're not interested in the Nazis anymore. We're concentrating on the communists.
So began the morality of the Cold War. Anything goes. The struggle required a mentality of permanent war, a perpetual state of emergency. And it meant a vast new apparatus of power that radically transformed our government. Its foundations were laid when President Truman signed into law the National Security Act of 1947.
Now, that National Security Act of 1947 changed dramatically the direction of this great nation. It established the framework for a national security state.
Admiral Jean LaRocque rose through the ranks from ensign to become a strategic planner for the Pentagon and now heads the Center for Defense Information, a public interest group.
The National Security Act of 47 gave us the National Security Council. Never have we had a National Security Council so concerned about the nation's security that we were always looking for threats and looking how to orchestrate our society to oppose those threats. National security was invented almost in 1947, and now it has become the prime mover of everything we do is measured against something we invented in 1947. The National Security Act also gave us the Central Intelligence Agency.
This is the house the Cold War built, the CIA, the core of the new secret government. Its chief legitimate duty was to gather foreign intelligence for America's new role as a world power. Soon it was taking on covert operations, abroad and at home. As its mission expanded, the CIA recruited adventuresome young men like Notre Dame's All-American, Ralph McGehee.
I look back to the individual that I was when I joined the agency. I was a dedicated cold warrior who felt the agency was out there fighting for liberty, justice, democracy, and religion around the world. And I believed wholeheartedly in this. I just felt proud every day that I went to work because I was out at the vanguard of the battle against the international evil empire, international communist, the evil empire.
Iran, 1953. The CIA mounted its first major covert operation to overthrow a foreign government. The target was the Prime Minister of Iran, Mohammad Mossadegh. He held power legitimately through his country's parliamentary process, and he was popular. Washington had once looked to him as the man to prevent a communist takeover. But that was before Mossadegh decided that the...
What you've been listening to is part one of a three-part segment, The Secret Government by Bill Moyers. Why is this relevant today when that was done in 1987? Because today it is merely the secret government on steroids. The secret government of the National Security Agency spying illegally on every person. Too big to fail, too big to jail corporations that control the system. Secret $16 trillion payments by the Federal Reserve to 22 banks. All of those banks were complicit in the downfall of the economy. The police acting as if judge, jury, and executioner. If a person stole something, not robbed something, there's a very big difference. The media is projecting the person robbed instead of stole. Then arrest that person for theft and let a judge or a jury decide that faith. But the police take it upon themselves today to taser, to shoot, to kill, and then walk with impunity away from that. That's a police state. The Trans-Pacific Partnership, done in secret by 600 corporations. That's a police state. The National Defense Authorization Act, a police state. The Patriot Act, a police state. The Patriot Act II, a police state. FISA courts, a police state. The secret lobbying efforts for 35 years, the American Legislative Exchange Council meeting with your state representatives to draft bills that become law to protect them and harm you, a police state. And of course, the irony is that today we have a John Kerry who was speaking out honestly and legitimately, who now is one of the architects of the problem. So this is relevant. We will continue it tomorrow. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. Let's now say hello to Utrice Lead. Hi, Utrice.
Hello, Gary. Today we're headed to what the young people of Ferguson, Missouri are calling Ground Zero, the base camp from which they're organizing both for justice and against sellout leadership.
Well, there'll be leadership selling them out. Thank you. Back with Utrice in a moment. Please stay with us.